WBFO and AM 970, in partnership with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York, presents Good For You, increasing quality and lowering the cost of healthcare in Western New York. Hello, I'm Jim Ranney, and I am joined today by four well-respected experts in the area of healthcare. Please welcome to our studio Dr. Andrea Mannion. She is a primary care physician and associate dean of student affairs at the UB School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences and clinical chief of family medicine for Kaleida Health System. Karen Blount is an RN and a vice president of healthcare services for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York. Dan Pereca, executive director of HealthyLink, the electronic medical records exchange for Western New York. And Sarah Gardner is director of communications and business development for the P2 Collaborative of Western New York. P2 stands for Pursuing Perfection to Build and Sustain Healthy Communities in Western New York. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here today. When we talk about healthcare, quality is something that certainly we all want. In fact, we expect it. We want well-trained doctors, nurses, and technicians working with the latest that science has to offer in state-of-the-art facilities. We demand drugs and treatment that will cure what ails us. But despite our high expectations for quality care, we are often shocked by the cost associated with it. Why does an MRI cost so much? Why do some prescription drugs cost thousands of dollars? Here are some numbers to consider. In 2010, health expenditures in the United States neared $2.6 trillion. By 2020, that number is projected to jump to $4.6 trillion. The rising cost of health care make health insurance less affordable for individuals and for families and put pressure on businesses that offer insurance coverage to their employees. So what can we do to maintain or increase the quality of care but lower the cost? That's the subject of our program today, and there are things happening here in Western New York that we want to talk about, things that we are doing well in this community, but things that we can also do better as we move forward. So, folks, let me start with quality first of all, and I'll ask each of you to comment generally on the quality of care in Western New York. I would say that when I look at this area, this region, that we're fortunate that we have some great hospitals, well-respected hospitals and healthcare facilities. Some specialize in areas like cancer and pediatric care and heart disease, stroke, things like that. But how, again, would each of you assess the quality of healthcare that we receive here in Western New York? Dr. Mannion, I'll start with you.
Thank you. We just talked for a moment indoors, and we're discussing some recent statistics that had come out describing Western New York and some of the things that we ought to be proud of. The first of which are the neurosurgical services in the Kaleida Health System and GVI, as it has been recently recognized by the U.S. News and World Report. In addition to neurosurgical services, we've known that Roswell Park has also been recognized, as well as Children's Hospital, for its care of pediatric patients. Those are national benchmarks, but I think as we move along, we're going to talk more about the quality as it affects individuals.
Karen Blount from Blue Cross Blue Shield, what do you think?
That certainly there's adequate access to various specialty and subspecialty services that make healthcare very quality-driven in this area. I think that one of the disadvantages that we have overall in the healthcare delivery system is quality is generally very subjective, that in New York State there are very few measures that give objective views around quality. Hospital Compare, for example, is information that's usually a year or 2 years old. There's not mandatory reporting in the state of New York as there are in other states around hospital-acquired infections, for example. So I think that we have a long way to go to actually know if we have quality. Certainly as a Western New Yorker who's worked in the healthcare delivery system here and in other parts of the country, I think we have some excellent physicians and healthcare facilities. But as we go about quantifying this to the person who pays the bill, which is the individual member and the employer, Again, I think you said it earlier, quality is assumed. It's an expectation. It isn't something people feel they have to pay extra for. And so there is a disconnect between the healthcare delivery system, who feels when they provide quality they should get increased reimbursement, to the person who buys it and expects quality. And as one employer said to me, Karen, when I buy a car, I don't expect to pay more for it to start off the lot. And that really is the thinking in the community.
Dan Pareka from HealthyLink, what do you think about quality in general?
Well, thanks, Jim. I think there's some indicators, some very positive indicators. The Commonwealth Fund Commission recently came out with a report that suggested we rank among 306 communities in the country among the top 10% relative to access and affordability, and in the top quartile relative to prevention and treatment. And I think that's a testament to the collaboration, to the work of the health plans and hospitals in our community. From my perspective and from where I sit, use of technology has really been taking hold. We've been recognized by the federal government as one of the 17 beacon communities in the country. And that was based on the collective use of health information technology here in the community and within the physician office. Better information equals better quality of service and better quality of care. If your doctors have the information that they need, they can take better care of you.
And Sarah Gardner from the P2 Collaborative, your thoughts?
To Dan's point, we are one of 16 alliances, Western New York is, across the United States that have been given grant monies by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to be aligning forces for quality community. So we've been given grant money to go and assist practices, in especially primary care practices, in PCMH adoption. PCMH is patient-centered medical home. So it focuses on comprehensive care, patient-centered care, and coordinated care with accessible services. We've been able to put practice enhancement associates into several primary care practices within Western New York to increase the quality of care and to increase outcome. So when we talk about high quality and low cost, if you think about primary care, and that is sort of where your care starts, it's 10 to 15% of your healthcare costs, but it drives 70% of total cost. So making sure that we are improving the quality at the primary care level is very important, and we, fortunately, in Western New York are leading that.
Karen, you mentioned access. How critical is that to, first of all, measuring quality? The fact that we have a renowned cancer center here in Western New York, something that perhaps we take for granted, but let's face it, many communities don't have that.
That's a very good point. That certainly the first step is access. If you look at the next closest national cancer center is in Sloan Kettering in New York City. They're a very high-cost provider, as well as for Western New Yorkers to leave and have to fly or drive to somewhere that's 8-10 hours away and have to stay, pay to stay there would be a significant hardship, as well as the value of having a freestanding women and children's hospital. Many communities do not have children's hospitals. Children and their families have to fly sometimes hundreds of miles in order to access that care. So access is certainly the first step in achieving quality care for a community.
Dr. Mannion, what about access for you as a primary care physician? How big of a deal is that for you when you know, for the most part, you've got some resources here where you can send your patients?
Access to primary care is probably the foundational element that we will continue to discuss here. And we're challenged. We're challenged across the whole country. When we look at the United States in comparison to our similar collegial countries around the world, for example, in Great Britain, in Germany, in Australia, New Zealand, we're very far behind in terms of the ratio of primary care physicians to specialists. In the United States, we see about one-third of practicing physicians serving as primary care docs. In these other countries where quality exceeds ours and cost is far less, they have many, many more primary care physicians to the number of 50%. So if our country can achieve 40% in terms of the ratio of generalists to specialists, we will find that will improve our quality and decrease our costs. We can talk a little bit more about how to do that.
Yeah. Sarah Gardner, you're nodding your head in agreement here. You talked about primary care physicians and the important role they play. Do we have enough of them here in Western New York?
P2 actually worked on a primary care need index. That index is made up of four different components. First of all, it is emergency room treat and release, meaning somebody used the emergency room the way that they would normally use primary care. The second one is a preventable diagnosis that was admitted. The second one is access, sort of population access, and the next is socioeconomic status, which is poverty. So here in Western New York, and I actually brought a map, but you can't see it on the radio, we have pockets of Western New York that the red sections here, so it's primarily the east side of Buffalo and the west side of Buffalo and some of the rural areas where you see that there we do have a need for more primary care physicians.
And why are we not seeing people going into primary care? Why are folks perhaps choosing, as young medical students, to pursue a specialty as opposed to being a general practitioner? And I'll throw that out to anyone on the panel that wants to take a stab. Dr. Mannion?
The Association of American Medical Colleges conducts what they call a graduation survey. So at the graduation of medical school, they have an extensive questionnaire to all students asking them, why did you choose your particular discipline? And by far and away, the number one reason students choose careers and specialty disciplines is for lifestyle. Students do not state that they have done that for financial reasons. However, we know that the debt, the average debt of a medical student upon graduation across the country is about $220,000 per student. So that tends to drive people into disciplines where they have more financial security.
Specialists make more money?
By a factor of three.
Okay. All right. Dan Parecka, what about technology? What role is technology playing in quality here in Western New York?
Well, there's access to information. If the doctor knows what drugs have already been prescribed for you, they won't order you something that could have contraindications. That's one example. Care coordination. When you talk about patients with complex conditions who go to see multiple doctors, their primary care plus a cardiologist, podiatrist, you know, in the case of diabetes, there is this coordination of care that is required, that is really necessary, and by leveraging technology, we're putting the pipes in place to make sure that information flows seamlessly, so the doctors have the information that they need, again, so they can get access to the data. The ability for a doctor in the emergency room to pull information on a patient that they've never seen before, so they can make better decisions and hopefully get them on their way quicker and with a better treatment plan.
Beyond what folks have already said about primary care versus specialists, is there an area where we're lacking here in terms of quality, a service that perhaps we need that we don't currently have, or a service that we need to expand on? Is there an area where we're maybe a little bit behind?
There really isn't any area that we see Western New Yorkers go out of network for, other than liver and heart transplant, which are done ideally in Rochester.
Okay, great. We are in studio this afternoon on Good for You, and we are in talking with some healthcare experts about the quality of healthcare, cost of healthcare in Western New York. I'll remind you that our panelists for our radio audience, Dr. Andrea Mannion, a primary care physician and associate dean of student affairs at the UB School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences, Karen Blount, an RN and vice president of healthcare services for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York, Dan Parecka, Executive Director of HealthyLink, and Sarah Gardner, Director of Communications and Business Development for the P2 Collaborative of Western New York. Let's move into the area of cost. We've talked about quality. We're doing pretty well on quality, generally speaking. How about cost in Western New York? How do we, you know, rank there in terms of maybe the rest of the nation? Is healthcare here generally more expensive than other places, or less expensive?
I think it's hard to compare to the rest of the country because our health care costs are a reflection of the health, of the cost of living in this community. And as we were talking prior to the program starting about housing cost, for example. So you really can't, it's comparing apples and oranges. But if we look at, again, the Western New York level of increasing cost, it is high. It is seen as unsustainable to many employers. But we have to realize that the system is designed perfectly to give the results of costs that we get today. And that is that traditionally health insurers have rewarded high utilizing hospitals and physicians. And if you go back to the issue of specialists, they've traditionally gotten paid more. Primary care doctors have always gotten paid less. And so the system tends to default to increasing use of specialists because for the primary care doctor to spend more time in their office with the complex patient that they're not going to get reimbursed for, it's easier to send it to the specialist. Specialists tend to do more tests, to order more medications, and to certainly do far more procedures. So something that we're doing at Blue Cross and Blue Shield, as well as the other payers, we are disinvesting in specialists and reinvesting in primary care and really looking at how can we maximize the time that the primary care physician has to spend in their office and also reward them for their outcomes. So we're beginning to see the fruits of that, but it's a hard pill for a community that is primarily made up of specialists to swallow.
Dr. Mannion, I'm interested in your thoughts on that. Again, as a primary care physician, do you see that happening? Is there perhaps a change in attitudes when it comes to primary care versus specialist?
Well, it is happening, and patients are increasingly coming into our office. Sometimes I see as many as 4 new patients a day in my office. And in those 4 new patients a day, you might look at the roster and say, oh, this is a 28-year-old who's coming in for care today. But these are folks who have high levels of complexity. And I think that as we are learning as a community that primary care will help to increase the quality and lower the cost of your health care, patients are increasingly being directed to primary care docs to coordinate the care. But now these folks are complex, not straightforward, not simple. And so if we can manage that with practice enhancement assistance, with social work, by expanding the services that we have in any one primary care office, we can better take care of those patients, and family physicians are well positioned to do that.
What's driving the cost of healthcare today? What's the big driver, I guess? Costs are going up and up. Where is the greatest increase? Where are we seeing that, do you think? Sarah, any thoughts on that?
In my experience, I think that the largest increase that we've seen over the past several years is probably that healthcare and the delivery system has not been as organized. So when we talk about primary care, it's a physician organizing a patient's care. Sometimes when patients go to all different specialists, they tend to overuse. Tests are duplicated or tests may not be needed. So that's why, you know, we pull back and we talk about primary care because it's a good foundation to organize the care. Another important thing is really and truly engaging patients as active members of their care, helping them to understand, to ask the questions that they need to in order to reduce the cost and reduce the waste in care.
When we look at some national numbers again, each dollar spent on health care, about 31% of that goes to hospitals, 20% goes to physicians and clinical services, 10% for pharmaceuticals, 6% to nursing homes, 7% for administrative costs. Would you say, on average, we're in line with that in Western New York? Is Karen Blount from Blue Cross Blue Shield, is that typically how the healthcare dollar is spent here?
Yes. And just another point that really what is driving up cost in Western New York is utilization. Our unit costs are actually fairly reasonable. It's the overutilization of those costs, as well as technology in the framework of information is wonderful. But technology in the form of the latest and greatest MRI machine, the latest and greatest robot, Most of that adds a huge amount of cost to care without really changing quality. And so some of this has to be a mindset change for both hospitals and physicians, that the latest toy may not necessarily change outcomes for patients, but significantly adds to cost. And what traditionally has happened is providers feel if they build it, we will pay for it. That's not a sustainable way of delivering care.
Dan, what about technology? Again, you're with HealthyLink, and you know that's in large part has to do with the success of technology and using technology to help lower costs. But what about what Karen said, that the technology may also be driving up costs here?
Well, I look at it from I don't disagree with anything Karen said. I think there's another aspect of cost that's inefficiency. When you think about the process of a script written by a doctor on a piece of paper, you hand it to the patient, they walk out the door, they walk into a pharmacy, hand it to a pharmacist, maybe they can read it, and then they fill the script, hopefully correctly, and they walk out the door. That's the same way it was done 100 years ago. When you think about the use of technology, now here in Western New York, last year we estimate that 51% of the scripts written were done electronically. That's as compared to 36% nationally and compared to 17% in 2009. So there are strides that we're making here in the community through the efforts of P2, what we're doing with HealthyLink. But I think there's a huge inefficiency, and healthcare has been slow to adopt technology when it comes to information about patients. And I think as we look at, you know, some of the procedures, there are some amazing things doctors are doing these days, operations, minimally invasive operations that, you know, were a dream 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But we're just now starting to catch up when it comes to information about patients that can be transmitted and electronically and used by other doctors in the community.
Do you see doctors? I mean, the numbers suggest that doctors are coming on board with the use of technology in their offices and things like that. Are they more accepting of it? And what about patients? Where are they in all of this technology? Do they like it? Sarah?
I think to Dan's point, the meaningful use of technology, and that's something that both HealthyLink and P2 collaborate on, the meaningful use of technology within the practice setting will reduce the cost of care because we're making sure that there's not overutilization, that people aren't, you know, that we're able to reconcile people's medication as they go from specialist to primary care into the ER. But I think that patients are much more accepting of technology now. And I think also we've been working for a few years with our practice enhancement associates, which are essentially consultant-type people that go into the practices to help physicians understand how to meaningfully use electronic medical records. And through that and really coaching them, they are starting to accept it a whole lot more and understanding it makes their workflow so much easier and their practices are much more efficient.
Dr. Mannion, what do you hear from your patients when you deal with technology in your office and, you know, you're not looking at that chart anymore, you're looking at a laptop computer and you know, deciding on how to treat your patient?
Well, a chart rests nicely on your lap and gives you beautiful, you know, view to see the patient and make great eye contact. And now there's either a desktop monitor in front of us or the side of a laptop in front of us, really getting in the way sometimes of the doctor-patient relationship. But there are profound generational differences in physicians and how they use computers. And what we see are the younger generation of physicians are really quite able and facile with the computer in a way that doesn't interrupt the doctor-patient relationship. But at the same time, physicians who are in the older generations are adopting to the computers, and patients are increasingly recognizing the value of having their medical record is essentially a database that can be readily transferred from one healthcare venue, for example, a primary care office, to a specialist's office. So we're getting along. We're all getting better at it. But certainly it's wonderful to watch the students and how quick they are to be able to seamlessly use the computer in patient care.
Dan?
If I could just add, so from a patient perspective, we have over, in order to get access, in order for a doctor that is treating a patient to get access to the data that is available through HealthyLink, they need the patient's consent. The patient has to expressly consent there that this doctor can get access to my data. There have been over 400,000 consents that have been signed here in Western New York to date. 95% are yes. The patient is consenting for treating physicians to get access to their data. So I think that points to an acceptance and almost an expectation. When you think about what technology is available in the home, in the work, in the workplace, there's almost an expectation that doctors are going to be utilizing technology to better treat their patients. I know I have that expectation.
And this is not only helping to lower costs, but it does add to quality, right? I mean, give us an example, if you can, Dan, about how this technology might impact the type of care that you receive.
There was a primary care doctor whose patient was released from a hospital 2 weeks prior to their visit, so they were on a post-hospitalization visit. The doctor asked the patient, "Did you have an MRI done when you were in the hospital?" The patient didn't remember. The patient said no. The doctor went to our web application that allowed for the pull of the data from that hospital and from anywhere in Western New York virtually that they were seen, and discovered, in fact, they did have, actually it was a CAT scan. Actually, they did have the CAT scan. So the script that they had written for that patient to go get a CAT scan was torn up. Now, there's a cost aspect, so this CAT scan that was not necessary because the information that she required was available to her, but it was also good for the patient. They weren't exposed to radiation that was unnecessary. So there's a cost aspect, there's a quality aspect, you know, from a timing of access to the information these things tie together very nicely, cost and quality. As you increase the quality, cost will typically come down.
You are listening to Good For You on WBFO and AM 970. I'm Jim Ranney. We are in studio today with healthcare experts talking about the cost and quality of healthcare in Western New York. We have a studio audience here as well, and I invite their questions. If you have a question for anyone on our panel, jot it down on the cards provided. Hold that card up, and we'll have someone come around and collect those cards. I'll ask as many as time permits. Karen Blount from Blue Cross Blue Shield, I know that you, Blue Cross Blue Shield, is involved in a tiered system in terms of working with providers, working with hospitals locally. Explain that and how that fits into this whole idea of improving quality, lowering costs.
The purpose of our joint venture with Kaleida and our new physician network is really to align incentives. Everyone knows that their waste needs to come out of the system, but no one leg of the stool can be significantly disadvantaged. And if we keep on doing things the way we've always done them, which is either ask the providers for price concessions to significantly limit access to care by prior authorization and large administrative burdens, that really isn't going to get us to where we need to be. Where we need to be is to pay for outcomes, to utilize evidence-based care, and to reduce the administrative burden on physicians, as well as maximizing the use of information technology to better coordinate care. So through this joint venture, we are developing a tailored network product. So we are in the process of creating a physician network that will be about 500 physicians, 50% primary care, and 50% specialist, because we do realize that good, high-quality, low-cost care does come from the primary care office, and then utilizing the right specialist. And those physicians have committed to using evidence-based practice and to also look at and contribute to efficiency with the opportunity to share in those gains. Through that, we hope to deliver better value to the employers and the individuals who purchase insurance, and again, aligning incentives. So as we create more value, we're then returning and reinvesting that into the system, as opposed to the health plan keeping it all, the employer group keeping it all, or the providers trying to figure out how they can get more of it.
I understand the cost savings there. How do you maintain the quality then?
By really monitoring the use of evidence. So, for example, every college College of Family Practice, cardiology, et cetera, have standards that through peer review and publishing in literature that they have determined are the best way to take care of a specific disease state. And through working with our physicians, giving them resources in their offices for care coordination so that they can get that information and have those resources real time. We'll be working with the physicians to analyze their data, to give them constant feedback. And so, for example, the evidence tells us that someone with acute onset of back pain with no functional deficit does not require an MRI. However, we have a very high rate of ordering MRIs in this community for first onset of back pain. That's something that should be managed in the primary care office in conjunction with physical therapy, rest, medication, et cetera. So we will be able to look through charts, look through electronic medical records, and say, this is what the evidence says, are physicians practicing to that, and hold them accountable to do that.
Dr. Mannion, what do you think of that approach? Someone coming into your office, I've got some back pain, doesn't an MRI make sense?
Well, too much technology can be a problem. And so oftentimes what we've seen on these MRIs are incidental findings that are essentially normal from one human being to another. But maybe raise a question about the nature of that back pain. And let's take it a little step further. Maybe that patient would have a surgery that might not be necessary if a little time were taken in advance with medical treatment, with physical therapy. Perhaps that vertebrae would just adjust enough so that the back pain would vanish without the need for surgery. If the patient goes to surgery and has a complication, a blood clot, any other type of complication, then both the cost to the system has accelerated an increase as well as the quality to that individual patient. So more technology does not necessarily translate into better quality.
It makes sense as you explain it, as Karen explains the system as well, but I go back to that patient with an aching back. All I want is relief, and I want it now. It's got to be a tough conversation to have sometimes. We're going to hold off. We're going to try a different approach. Sarah, what would you say to the patient who says, right now I don't care about the cost. I want relief. I want, something to take the pain away.
I think that conversation should start well before the situation gets to crisis. We, through P2, we also contract consumer engagement associates who really are out into the community teaching people to understand the healthcare system and how it works. I go back to the importance of asking questions and the importance of having a good, solid relationship with your physicians so that you're able to ask questions of your primary care physician. Okay, I'm in a lot of pain. What do you think is the best approach? And then having that good relationship so they can say, well, you know what, maybe this is going to take some time. I understand that you're in pain right now, but let's try physical therapy. Let's try rest. But really engaging the consumer before everything gets to crisis mode so that they understand what role they play in the healthcare system.
And again, primary care being key to this, starting with the primary care physician as opposed to that specialist.
Absolutely.
Karen Blount, though, if the primary care physician thinks a specialist is needed, if a patient wants to see a specialist, can they do it?
Yes. So this does not limit certainly doesn't limit the primary care provider from referring to a specialist when appropriate. And a patient can certainly see a specialist. But again, through that education, and we do have to realize that this is a society of instant gratification. And so a lot of this is community education and conversations like this to say it's not always the best care to get the most stuff. Bad things happen to people in hospitals. And so to rush to unnecessary surgery is never a step towards quality. So a lot of this is, frankly, there's a lot of frustration on the physician community side that patients play a major part in cost drivers. They don't call their doctor. They go to the emergency room. They go to the urgent care center. They do have this need to be better right now. So if you give me an antibiotic, even though I have a cold, I feel better. So they are really looking to patients to have more accountability for what they do. You know, they order appropriate testing and medication for people with chronic illnesses, and people don't go get their prescription filled. But yet the physician is held accountable for their outcomes, with sometimes not the ability to affect people's personal accountability.
Let's talk about prescriptions for a minute, because that's an area that I think a lot of people are concerned with. We see an increase in prescriptions, in the cost of prescriptions and so forth. But perhaps as a consumer, we sometimes feel, we have no control over that. How can I prevent, if my doctor prescribes a medicine, I can't control the cost of that. What about prescription drugs? How big of a issue is the cost of prescriptions in the overall cost of healthcare today?
Well, more often than not, there are alternatives. Alternatives that are less expensive, frankly. In nearly every drug category that I prescribe regularly as a family physician, there are generic alternatives, and there are always lower-cost alternatives. For patients who are paying out of pocket, they make sure to ask me what those alternatives are. And together, actually when you use the electronic health record, they'll often tell you what a lower-cost alternative will be for the physician. And again, these medications are interchangeable. There's a lot of flexibility in how we prescribe medications for hypertension, for high cholesterol, for infections that always have a lower cost alternative.
Dan, does record sharing help with that, with prescription drugs, in terms of keeping track of not only what's been prescribed or what's worked or hasn't worked in the past, but what is working with other patients?
Sure, and I think the more, and really we're just starting to scratch the surface. As you get more and more information, you can start doing the analytics, right? You can start understanding based on the symptoms that a patient shows up with, based on the type of treatment that they've been provided, and then combine that with the drugs that have been prescribed, what is really effective. And I wanted to pick up on Dr. Mannion's point on information overload. There is a big concern. As we get more and more data, we need to be careful how we present that, because if it's too much, then it becomes noise and it's not used. So one of the things that we're always cognizant of is how is it presented and how is it used. If the information is in digital format, so if you think about the manila folder that we all grew up with, the patient, the doctor's record, it's very hard to analyze the data that's on pieces of paper within a manila folder. But when you start digitizing that and you start putting the record in electronic form, then you can start doing some of the analysis. How many of my patients are due for an exam, a breast exam, or a PSA test, or... How can we now? You can start impacting proactively, as Sarah referenced, the care of the patient. So we need the patients engaged. We need the physicians and the healthcare community utilizing the technology in an effective way. And as we get more and more data, we can start analyzing the results that we have.
We have some great questions from our audience here, and I'll toss these out. I'll ask you to respond to. Whoever wants to respond can respond to these questions as we go. A question about access. Do we have too much access? Too many hospitals providing the same service, like cardiac and cancer, et cetera? Do redundancies of service drive up costs?
I guess it's the person Karen representing Blount from Blue the Cross people Blue paying Shield. The bills. I'll try that. Do we have a lot of redundancy? Yes. We certainly have more than enough MRI machines, more than enough CAT scans. In the area of cardiac care, it would be ideal in a community this size if there were one location that were doing cardiovascular procedures. It's an expensive procedure, and frankly, the more you do, the better your outcomes. So in that aspect, we probably don't need more than one significant cardiovascular provider.
Others on the panel, care to chime in on access? Do we have more hospitals than we need? There's certainly been a reduction, I think, in recent years in the number of hospital beds. Is that helping the situation at all?
Well, I guess I want to shift the concept of access from hospital to primary care.
Okay.
in the sense that we don't have enough primary care physicians in Western New York, as Sarah described to you, particularly in the high-need areas, rural communities, urban communities. And it's that aspect of the healthcare system where access is the most critical. What we're looking to do is, as we engage every person with a primary care physician, as has been tested by other pilot studies across the country, the care, the cost of care for inpatient medicine will decline considerably, whereas the cost for primary care may go up some, but not as much as the cost savings and the decline on the inpatient side. So again, I want to consider really the primary access point where patients are on the ground walking into the healthcare system.
And we have a question about that. Sarah, go ahead if you want to chime in.
I think to that point, there's sort of a good success story. Chautauqua County, who's obviously in the eight counties of Western New York, one of our rural counties, the Chautauqua County Health Network has started a new recruitment process for physicians. So they're tracking graduates that are from Chautauqua County as they go and are interested in going through medical school. They have applied for funding for loan forgiveness for, you know, to recruit people back to those rural areas because there is a need for primary care physicians. So I think that if we talk about successes of Western New York, we are all working together in order to recruit physicians back home so that we are able to fill that need.
Question from the audience about the Affordable Care Act, bringing new initiatives to medical students in becoming primary doctors, and reimbursements will be increased to primaries in 2013, according to the question here. Do you think this will help in terms of recruiting more primary care physicians? Dr. Mannion?
It's helped in other parts of the world. So in other countries, those that I described earlier, the difference in physician reimbursement between specialists and generalists is compressed significantly. Not that primary care physicians earn more than we do here in the United States, but the specialists earn less. In Canada, when they faced a similar problem, because they're paid through the government, they increased the salaries of primary care physicians and found a dramatic increase in the choice of medical students, therefore. Forbes magazine just recently published an article that said that primary care physician salaries are going up and that specialist salaries are going up, but just a little bit. So that relatively speaking, we're moving toward, and no one wants equalization and no one expects equalization. Certainly specialists have many more years of training and therefore more debt and have higher technical interventions with patients, and that does pay more money as we are in our current system.
The Affordable Care Act enforces many free preventative services. Will this bring cost effectiveness and make people healthier?
I think forces is a strong word. I think it makes available is probably a better way to put it.
Okay. What about the emphasis on preventative services? Seems to be, you know, that's what kind of the HMO system was all about, preventative. Is that still the kind of the mantra?
Prevention is the ideal way to practice good health care. Obviously, someone having a mammogram and recognizing a small stage one breast cancer is much better than someone not having their mammogram for 10 years and having stage 4 metastatic cancer. So that is one of the very good things about the Affordable Care Act that I don't think is talked about enough, that it does provide people access with no copay at all for preventive care. And that is critical in improving compliance. If we look at some of our rates in Western New York, for example, around colorectal screening, it's in the 50% average, and that's really not where we want to be. So we're missing people who potentially have colon cancer that can be easily treated until they're much farther along in their disease, which not only drives up cost, but obviously significantly impacts the person's outcome around quality.
Another question from the audience about is there a place in the traditional healthcare system for holistic medicine? Would you utilize holistic medicine in your practice? Dr. Mannion, I'll start with you on this.
Well, the word holistic brings into your thoughts many, many things, you know, whether it's massage therapy, aromatherapy, homeopathic medication, naturopathic medication, nutritional counseling. And certainly a family physician can work with the patient who sees other providers of healthy services to enhance the life and the well-being of that individual patient. So we do tend to work very well with patients who are seeking alternate medical care, as long as it's truly understood. And so sometimes patients will spend large amounts of money on alternative options, but yet not come in for their regular visits, or perhaps they won't give up smoking. So there is a trade-off. And what I wanted to just mention, though, before prevention is lifestyle change. And if you're not being able to have conversations with your physician who can serve as a lifestyle coach, whether it's early intervention for weight gain, for example, or smoking cessation, or improving fitness throughout the lifespan, those are the things that are really key to maintaining health.
Dan, some thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's a great point. When we talk about, so one of the initiatives as part of our Beacon project is putting telemonitoring devices in a patient's home. Diabetics who are high risk and have congestive heart failure. And so what we're trying to do is prevent, get them to the, and catch them before they are requiring hospitalization. But the challenge now is if you can put all the technology you want in a patient's home and you can manage and monitor, but if they don't stop smoking, if they don't stop eating the wrong foods, if they don't exercise, the technology is not going to have the impact. The patient really needs to be engaged. They need to understand what the impact is. Now, what the monitoring can do is allow for care coordinators, care managers, to nurses, for example, to make a call and say, are you really following the protocol that we established because your numbers aren't showing any progress. But I think that's the point I wanted to make was that the patients really need to be engaged and want to get healthy.
Are you seeing that more and more out there? Are patients more inclined to become engaged and to question doctors and to question treatment options that they have? It might be perhaps a generational thing. What do you think?
I think that it's been a constant struggle to get patients to be engaged. I think that it is largely generational. I think that we see some of the older generations that always thought of their physician as the end-all, and they would never question it, whereas younger generations have no problem questioning everything. So I think that in engaging patients and teaching them how to navigate the healthcare system, it's important that we communicate to everybody and let them know how important and crucial it is that they play an active role in their care.
Dr. Mannion, you want patients questioning your decisions?
Patients are my partners. So, we work together for their health, and I need to understand what their thinking is. And so, yeah, I want them to question me or to ask me for a less expensive alternative or to bring in things they've printed out from the internet or recommendations from, for example, a Chinese medicine provider. So bring it to me, and let's work together.
Question from the audience, talking about patients being engaged. For patients paying out of pocket, it's nearly impossible to get a price on treatment ahead of time. How much an office visit will cost, how much a procedure will cost. Why is that?
A lot of it is because it just has never been required or asked for, because when your employer is paying the bill, you frankly don't care. Blue Cross, as an association nationally, is actually in the process of putting information like that on our website for our members to access, as well as we have some tools as we transform our technology platform that people will not only be able to see that, but see where they are in spending with their high deductible health plan, for example, how close they are to getting to the deductible. So health plans are certainly realizing, as we go to more of an individual market and people with high deductible health plans, that information is critical for people to be able to make those decisions.
Sarah, what about that? I mean, should doctors have kind of a, here's the price list, this is what it costs for a checkup. This is what it costs for, a certain procedure.
In my previous position, in my previous employment, I worked on a reference pricing project with a company called Healthcare Blue Book, which is out of Atlanta, and they were able to, in some geographic locations, give us a spread of the cost of certain procedures, mostly high-tech radiology, endoscopy, and other outpatient procedures. It was an excellent tool for consumers to see, you know, that maybe at one place you would have a sleep study that cost $2,800, but you could go down the street and actually get the same quality and the same test for $900. I think that in certain areas of the country, they're able to get that information and report on it differently than we are in New York State. So that's to be seen.
It must be a frustration. I know it's a frustration for sure for patients. What about for you folks in the system when you see that, when you hear about discrepancies like that? Karen, is there anything the insurance companies are doing to look at the cost and why this procedure costs this much here as opposed to over there?
So we reimburse based on the procedure generally on a community fee schedule. Okay. So there wouldn't be a sleep study with that much variability. There in the past had been contracts with unique arrangements that we've really gotten away from. So a MRI is reimbursed at X no matter where you go in the system. But that was something that I think maybe 5 years ago was more prevalent. But most payers pay generally on a community fee schedule.
Dan, anything with electronic record keeping that is dealing with price? Are prices more, the cost perhaps of healthcare more readily available to patients and maybe even doctors when it's delivered electronically?
I would suggest that we can impact the cost of care through efficiency. We're not really addressing access to pricing. Mm-hmm. I would say, to the question that was asked, it's probably just a function of doctors aren't used to being asked. So they're not prepared for the question. How much would it cost if I walked in and paid you cash? Technology can be leveraged in a lot of ways. And I think what we're attempting to do is put the foundation in place for improving quality through better use of that. But, it's not in our kind of purview to come up with the price list,
right,
per se.
We're almost out of time. We haven't spent much time at all talking about the Affordable Care Act. I don't want to debate the Affordable Care Act and the future of the Affordable Care Act, but I am interested from all of you, what you think the impact, if the law does in fact take effect, what impact will it have here in Western New York on quality and cost? Sarah, can we start with you?
Sure. I think that I speak about it from a consumer perspective, and something that we're doing at P2 is creating consumer engagement programs that help people get ready to understand the exchanges. So when we talk about a consumer being an active member in their healthcare team, As consumers go into 2014 needing to make more decisions about what they're going to choose in terms of their plan, getting them ready to understand how the healthcare system works, getting them to understand how what that means to them financially, what that means to them in terms of financial risk, and how to plan better for their family. So I think that when we're talking about a big part of the quality and the cost of care is you as a consumer being engaged. Our dedication at the P2 Collaborative is getting consumers ready for all of those decisions and some of the changes that they'll have to navigate.
Dan Pareko, what do you think?
So, we're focused on quality of care. The Affordable Care Act talks about payment. There are different models: the accountable care organizations, patient-centered medical homes, health homes. There are a lot of concepts that are in this act that. Frankly, it's important to understand that with or without it, we have a problem relative to efficiency. and we're in the process of doing things, as Karen talked about, you know, to reimburse doctors for quality of care as opposed to quantity of care. And I think those are important elements that we all need to recognize. And as we get to a more and more recognition and adoption of whatever it is, I think there's a recognized need, and which is good, and we're attempting to do something about it.
Karen Blount from Blue Cross Blue Shield.
The best thing that the Affordable Care Act has done is forced the conversations. Because for example, our collaboration between Kaleida and our physicians would not have occurred 10 years ago, and there was really, frankly, no need for it. So as far as change in the healthcare delivery system, the train has left the station regardless of the legislation. What the Affordable Care Act, if it continues, will do is expand access to people who right now are uninsured that we all have to realize we're paying for now. So what commercially insured plans have to do today is reimburse particularly hospitals that have high levels of uncompensated care at a higher rate, which is paid for by the commercial members. So this thinking that we are not incurring costs today for the uninsured is simply not factual. We are incurring higher costs because people, instead of being able to spend the $80 or $100 to go see their doctor and get a prescription filled, wait till they're very ill and they take an ambulance to an emergency room that by law has to treat them, and then they end up in an intensive care unit. So the changes in the delivery system will occur with or without the legislation. What the legislation does enable us to do is to afford reasonable access to people who today don't have it.
Dr. Mannion, you have the final word on this.
Well, actually, I want to amplify what Karen said, and that is the Affordable Care Act will expand coverage in such a way that we will all pay less money for all of us. And the fact that uninsured folks right now cannot access primary care or will not access primary care as they're paying out of pocket to prevent the major heart attack, to prevent the stroke, to prevent the problems that lead to that ICU admission and lengthy hospitalizations, which then set them back socially and financially in life to really never catch up again. So expanding the care to those who are really needing it the most, and therefore taking the burden off the payer system, will be to all of our advantage.
Dr. Mannion, thank you very much for your time. Karen Blount from Blue Cross Blue Shield, thank you. Dan Pereca, Executive Director of HealthyLink, thanks for being here. And Sarah Gardner, Director of Communications and Business Development for the P2 Collaborative of Western New York. Thank you all for being here and sharing your expertise. Thank you to our audience in studio here and on the radio as well. Thanks for joining us for Good For You, the program presented by WBFO and AM 970 in partnership with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York. I'm Jim Ranney. Have a great day.